Have you ever noticed that you just don't handle stress the way you used to? Like maybe you're a bit more reactive to small things, or your brain feels foggy after a long week and you just find it significantly harder to bounce back. We often frame this as, a personal failing. We tell ourselves we just need to try harder or get more organized or maybe read another self-help book. But what if it's not a character flaw at all? What if what you were experiencing is a literal physiological reality?
Yeah, and that requires a fundamental shift in how we view our own reactions and behaviors. Because when you experience chronic stress, particularly early in your life, your brain doesn't just passively process it and move on.
Well, he leaves a mark.
Exactly. The actual physical architecture of your brain is literally rewired by that experience. The hardware itself changes.
And that is exactly the mission of our deep dive today. We are pulling from this really fascinating stack of sources to figure out what is actually happening under the hood when we experience long-term stress. We're looking at clinical insights from psychiatrist Dr. Tracy Marks, the groundbreaking Adverse Childhood Experiences study, and some incredibly dense but really revealing psychiatric literature from Frontiers in Psychiatry and the journal Psychoneuroendocrinology.
A bit of a mouthful, that one.
Right. But we're going to unpack the origins of stress, the exact biological mechanisms that alter our brains, the clinical evidence of what this does to our bodies, and most importantly, what we can do to reverse it. No overwhelming jargon, just a shortcut for you to be well-informed.
It is a profound journey, really, to connect the dots between the experiences of our childhood and the physiology of our adulthood. And to really understand this, we have to start in a rather unexpected place.
Okay, I'm keen to dig in. Where do we start?
Well, the origins of our modern medical understanding of trauma didn't actually start in a psychiatric ward or a neuroscience lab. They started in an obesity clinic in California in the late 1980s.
Right. I was reading through the background on this. Dr. Vincent Felitti's clinic at Kaiser Permanente.
That's the one.
This is such a surprising origin story for trauma research. He was running this highly successful, medically supervised fasting program. And patients were losing significant amounts of weight, sometimes over 100 pounds.
Massive transformation.
Yeah. But then something strange started happening. And this is where I'm hoping you can shed some light, because from a treatment perspective, it sounds like a complete disaster.
It did at the time, yes.
They were either rapidly regaining the weight or just dropping out of the program entirely, right when they were at their most successful. I mean, why would someone abandon a program that is visibly working for them?
From a purely traditional medical standpoint, it made no sense at all. Dr. Felitti was totally baffled. So instead of just, looking at their diets or their calorie intake, he started conducting deep qualitative interviews with these patients.
Just talking to them.
Exactly. He sat down and essentially asked them to explain the why behind the relapse. And what he uncovered during those conversations completely shifted the paradigm of how we view addiction and weight. He found that for a significant number of these patients, the obesity wasn't the core problem they were suffering from. It was a coping mechanism.
Meaning the weight was actually serving a purpose.
Precisely. Many of these patients revealed horrific histories of unresolved childhood trauma, particularly sexual abuse. For them, being overweight functioned as a physical and psychological buffer.
Ah, I see
It
it.
was a way to make themselves invisible or to build a literal physical barrier between themselves and a world they perceived as deeply unsafe. So when they lost the weight, they lost their armor.
That is heartbreaking.
They felt overwhelmingly vulnerable, so the mind and body basically conspired to put the armor back on.
So the overeating was an attempted solution to a much older, deeper problem. And that specific revelation in an obesity clinic led to this massive collaboration with the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, creating what we now know as the ACE study, the Adverse Childhood Experiences study.
A monumental piece of research.
They ended up surveying over 17,000 adult patients. And looking at the framework, they broke these childhood experiences down into three main categories. First, abuse, which includes physical, emotional, and sexual abuse. Second, neglect, both physical and emotional. And third, household dysfunction.
Right, which covers things like domestic violence, substance abuse, untreated mental illness, or having an incarcerated parent.
And the statistics that came out of this study, I mean, they were a wake-up call for the entire medical community. They found that 64% of people have experienced at least one ACE, and 17% Nearly one in six people have an ACE score of 4 or more.
It's staggering.
But here's where it gets really interesting, and I have to push back a little on the scope of those numbers based on our notes here.
Mm-hmm.
That 64% figure is almost certainly a massive underrepresentation.
Oh, without a doubt.
Because if you look at the methodology, the original study was conducted mostly with middle class, primarily white HMO members in San Diego who had access to good health care. It didn't even account for broader structural factors like extreme poverty, community violence, living through a war, or systemic racism.
Yeah.
If we factor those in, we are talking about an issue that touches almost everyone to some degree. So if the origins are this common, what is this actually doing to our hardware?
That is the crucial context, and the long-term adult health consequences are alarming. The researchers found a direct dose-response relationship.
Meaning the higher the score, the worse the outcome.
Exactly. The higher your ACE score, the worse your health outcomes decades later. For someone with an ACE score of 6, there's a 5,000% increase in the likelihood of a suicide attempt compared to someone with a score of 0.
5,000%. That is unreal.
And it's not just mental health. It drives autoimmune conditions, heart disease, diabetes. The JAMA study we looked at quantified this, estimating that the annual cost to the nation in medical spending and lost productivity linked directly to ACEs is $14.1 trillion.
Okay, let's unpack this. We have this massive epidemiological data showing that a difficult childhood translates into chronic physical illness 30 or 40 years later. But how?
Right, the mechanism.
Yeah, what is this actually doing to our hardware? If I experience a traumatic event at age 7, what is the exact biological mechanism that causes me to develop heart disease or severe brain fog at age 40?
To understand the how, we have to look at the way the human brain actually grows. There is a physiological concept called the neurosequential model.
Okay.
It essentially means the brain develops hierarchically from the bottom up. At birth, your vital brain stem, the primitive part that controls autonomic functions like breathing, heart rate, and body temperature, is fully functional.
Makes sense. You need that to survive straight away.
Right. But the complex higher order areas like the prefrontal cortex, which handles nuanced emotional regulation and future planning, well, they take years, even decades, to fully organize and wire together.
And during this decades-long construction project, the brain goes through these sensitive periods, right? Mm-hmm. These are specific windows of time where the neural pathways are highly plastic, highly adaptable, and deeply sensitive to whatever environment the child is in.
Yes, precisely. Now, under ideal circumstances, a child has a supportive, regulating caregiver. When the child gets stressed, the caregiver soothes them. This external regulation allows the child's internal emotional circuits to develop at a normal, healthy, gradual pace.
But what if they don't have that?
When a child faces chronic, toxic stress without that safe caregiver support, the brain makes a terrifying calculation. It triggers what is known as the stress acceleration model.
Oh, wow.
The brain essentially assesses the environment and says, this world is dangerous. I don't have the luxury of developing slowly. So it forces the emotional and survival circuits to mature prematurely.
It's an evolutionary survival mechanism. You need to grow up fast if you're in a war zone.
Uh-huh.
But the tragic cost of speeding up the timeline is that it abruptly closes those sensitive windows of brain development way too early. The foundation is poured before the concrete has had time to properly set.
Exactly. And at the absolute center of this physiological storm is the HPA axis, the hypothalamic pituitary adrenal axis.
The body's main stress response system.
Yes. It's a communication line between your brain and your adrenal glands. When faced with a threat, it floods your body with adrenaline and cortisol to prepare you to fight or flee. For a child experiencing toxic stress, this HPA axis is firing constantly. Eventually, it can get stuck.
Stuck, like broken.
Stuck in one of two modes. It either gets stuck in hyperarousal, meaning a constant exhausting state of fight or flight, or it flips into hyperarousal, which is a biological state of freeze or shutdown.
Dr. Tracy Marks breaks this down brilliantly in The Sources by looking at the big three physical changes in the brain that result from this HPA axis dysregulation.
Hmm.
First, we have the amygdala. That's the brain's threat detection center, the alarm system. And under chronic stress, it literally undergoes hypertrophy. It gets physically bigger.
Because it is being flooded with stress hormones constantly, it builds up like a muscle that is being overworked at the gym. And because it is physically enlarged and hyperactive, its threshold for detecting a threat drops to near zero.
It's like having a car alarm that goes off every time a single leaf falls on the windshield. Your brain's security system is completely exhausted from false alarms.
That's a great way to put it.
You react intensely to a slightly passive-aggressive email because your enlarged amygdala is literally signaling your nervous system that you are in a life or death survival situation.
And while the amygdala is growing, the second major change is happening to the hippocampus, which is the brain's memory and learning hub. The hippocampus actually shrinks.
But why? How does stress make a brain region shrink?
It comes down to the toxicity of prolonged cortisol exposure. In short bursts, cortisol is helpful. But when the HPA axis is stuck open and cortisol is constantly washing over the brain, it becomes neurotoxic to the hippocampus.
It literally poisons it.
Essentially, yes. It damages the neurons, causing the branches of the brain cells, the dendrites, to retract, and it stops the generation of new brain cells. This structural damage is why chronic stress causes such profound brain fog, difficulty learning new tasks, and trouble recalling details.
Wow.
Your brain is expending so much metabolic energy on survival that the pathways required to form and access memories are physically degrading.
Which brings us to the third major change, the prefrontal cortex. This is the sophisticated part of the brain responsible for impulse control, complex decision-making, and keeping that hyperactive amygdala in check. I've heard it called the CEO of the brain.
Right.
But based on the mechanisms we're discussing, it sounds more like an air traffic controller whose radar screen is getting jammed by static.
That is a very accurate way to conceptualize it. Under chronic stress, the connectivity between the prefrontal cortex and the rest of the brain weakens. The signals just aren't getting through. The air traffic controller is still there, but they can't communicate with the planes.
That makes a lot of sense.
This is why highly stressed people often snap, make impulsive, short-sighted choices, or struggle to focus on complex tasks. Their higher order processing is basically offline.
And on top of all these structural changes, your daily cortisol rhythm gets completely flattened out. Normally, your cortisol moves in this healthy sine wave, right? It spikes in the morning to wake you up and give you energy, and it gradually drops through the afternoon and evening so you can sleep.
Exactly.
But chronic stress flattens that wave into a straight line. You don't get the morning spike, so you're exhausted all day, and it doesn't drop at night, leaving you in this miserable state of being wired but completely tired.
So we understand the hardware changes now. The next crucial step is looking at how this biological rewiring actually manifests in the real world, specifically in clinical settings. We reviewed a massive targeted literature synthesis from Frontiers in Psychiatry. It looked at patients with major depressive disorder, bipolar disorder, and psychosis.
And this is where I hit a bit of a roadblock in the reading, because the findings seem totally contradictory.
How so?
Well, in general, patients with major depressive disorder tend to show elevated daily cortisol levels. Their HPA axis is running hot. But when researchers looked at patients with bipolar disorder and psychosis, who also had a history of early life stress, they found a paradox.
Yes. The researchers expected to see skyrocketing cortisol in these trauma-exposed patients when they were put under pressure, but they saw the exact opposite. They used specific, highly validated stress tests. One is measuring the cortisol awakening response, which is that natural, necessary spike in cortisol you should get right after waking up. And another is the Trier social stress test.
Right, the Trier test, which sounds like an absolute nightmare, by the way.
Oh, it is.
They essentially force you to stand in front of a panel of unsmiling judges in white lab coats and do complex mental math out loud. And if you make a mistake, they coldly tell you to start over. It is designed to induce acute social and cognitive stress.
And in the bipolar and psychotic patients with early childhood trauma, their cortisol responses to these intensely stressful situations were dramatically blunted.
Really?
Yeah, they barely registered a spike. Their stress response was significantly attenuated compared to patients who hadn't experienced early life stress.
Wait, help me out here. If you throw someone in front of a hostile panel of judges and their stress hormone doesn't spike, isn't that a good thing? Doesn't that just mean they have a thick skin? Why is a blunted cortisol response considered a sign of damage rather than a sign of extreme resilience?
It is a really common misconception. A blunted cortisol response in this context does not mean the person is calm or resilient. The researchers found that these flattened responses occur on a background of what we call high allostatic load.
Let's define that term for a second because it pops up heaps in the literature. What exactly is allostatic load?
Allostatic load is the biological wear and tear on the body that accumulates after decades of chronic stress. Think of it like running a car engine in the red zone for years.
Okay, I'm with you.
The blunted response during the Trier test happens because their HPA axis has been hyperfunctioning churning out high levels of cortisol for so many years that the system is completely exhausted.
Ah, so it's not that they aren't stressed.
Right. There is literally no reserve capacity left in the adrenal glands to mount a proper, healthy response to a new acute stressor. The alternator has given out. It's not resilience. It's a hidden marker of severe physiological vulnerability. The tank is utterly empty.
That makes so much more sense. Wait, so you're saying that if someone doesn't seem to react to a stressful event, it might not be resilience. It might actually be that their stress system is so burnt out from childhood allostatic load that the tank is just completely empty.
Exactly that. It's a broken alarm system, not a strong one.
And this doesn't just show up in psychiatric illnesses. It manifests in physical pain, too. There was a fascinating study from psychoneuroendocrinology that looked at patients dealing with subacute back pain.
Yes, and to measure the health of the stress system in these back pain patients, researchers use something called a dexamethasone suppression test.
How exactly does that test work? The paper says it artificially manipulates the HPA axis, but what is it actually doing?
Dexamethasone is a synthetic steroid that acts very much like cortisol. Normally, when your brain detects high levels of cortisol in the blood, it sends a signal to shut down production. It's a feedback loop, like a thermostat shutting off the furnace when the house gets warm.
Right.
In this test, they give the patient a dose of dexamethasone at night. A healthy brain detects this synthetic cortisol and briefly suppresses its own natural cortisol production for the next morning.
But the back pain patients didn't have a normal response, did they?
No. The patients with severe back pain showed a hypersuppression of cortisol. Their system was so hypersensitive and dysregulated that the synthetic dose caused their natural production to completely crash.
Wow.
And critically, this hypersuppression negatively correlated with their pain intensity. The more dysregulated their HPA axis feedback loop was, the harder it crashed, the more intense their physical pain experience became.
So the stress system is actually driving the pain.
It strongly supports the idea that the way our brain regulates stress hormones is a major driving factor in whether an acute temporary injury transitions into chronic long-term physical pain.
It is heavy stuff to process. Realizing that our childhood environments can echo so deeply into our adult physical health, dictating everything from how our brain folds to how much our back hurts.
It is heavy, yes.
But here's the pivot, and it's a vital one. The brain is remarkably adaptable. Just as toxic stress can rewire the brain for survival, neuroplasticity works in reverse too. We can intentionally rewire the hardware for safety and resilience. So what does this all mean for someone listening?
That is the hope embedded in all this research. The brain is entirely capable of healing if given the right conditions. Dr. Tracy Marks outlines three highly effective evidence-based strategies to act as a buffer against this allostatic load and to start repairing the system. The first is perhaps the most fundamental biological need we have, sleep.
It's not just about feeling rested, is it? During deep, slow-wave sleep, the brain activates the glymphatic system, which acts as a literal cleanup crew.
Exactly.
It flushes cerebrospinal fluid through the brain tissue to wash out metabolic waste, including the toxic byproducts of stress hormones that damage the hippocampus. Dr. Marks really emphasizes the need for a strict, consistent bedtime to keep your circadian rhythm anchored, which helps restore that flattened cortisol sine wave.
Spot on. The second strategy is exercise, which she accurately calls brain medicine. You don't need to be running marathons or doing high-intensity interval training, which can actually spike cortisol if you overdo it.
Right. Keep it simple.
Even a 30-minute daily walk is enough to reduce systemic inflammation. More importantly, movement stimulates the release of a protein called BDNF, brain-derived neurotrophic factor. Think of BDNF as Miracle-Gro for the brain.
I love that analogy.
It actively promotes the growth of new neurons in that shrinking hippocampus, helping to reverse the physical damage caused by chronic stress.
And the third strategy is using what she calls stress circuit breakers. When you feel that overly sensitive amygdala alarm starting to wail, when you feel your heart rate spike over an email, you have to manually interrupt the loop before the cortisol floods your system.
Yes, and she recommends specific breathing techniques. 3 slow, deep breaths, a 4-count inhale and a 4-count exhale.
And that specific rhythmic breathing pattern is highly intentional. It's not just a distraction technique, is it?
Not at all. When you slow your exhale, you are mechanically stimulating the vagus nerve. This acts as a biological switch to activate your parasympathetic nervous system, which is your body's natural rest and digest response.
So you're hacking the system.
Essentially, yes. By manually slowing your respiration, you are sending a physical signal to the brainstem that the environment is safe, which forces the hyperactive HPA axis to stand down.
And we are seeing this move out of the lab and into the real world. Practitioners all over the globe are using these exact trauma-informed strategies to change lives. I was looking at some notes on local context, and Greg Jones, a certified practitioner based down in New Zealand, is a prime example of someone doing this vital work on the ground.
Oh, absolutely.
He utilizes these precise trauma-informed principles to help individuals safely regulate their nervous systems, essentially teaching them how to manually control their own physiological responses.
And it's important to recognize who this work applies to. It's not just for people with a clinical diagnosis or a high ACE score. The modern world subjects all of us to chronic stress. These nervous system regulation techniques are just as crucial for a corporate executive prepping for a high-stakes board meeting as they are for someone actively working through severe childhood adversity.
It applies to everyone.
The entire mechanism of post-traumatic growth relies on this foundational ability to regulate the nervous system. You cannot process trauma or perform at your highest level if your hardware is constantly locked in survival mode.
It really is a massive paradigm shift.
Yeah.
It means protecting your brain from stress isn't some luxury spa day. It's essential, non-negotiable biological maintenance.
Exactly.
You wouldn't drive a car for years without changing the oil, so you can't run your brain on chronic stress without doing the maintenance. Moving from self-blame, you know, why am I so reactive to self-regulation? Once you understand the mechanics of the HPA axis and the amygdala, you can stop fighting your own personality and start actively healing your physiology.
Yeah, that's the ultimate goal.
Whether you are dealing with a stressful work week or the echoes of childhood adversity, for you listening, your physiological responses are valid, they're measurable, and most importantly, they are manageable.
And this raises one final, truly cutting-edge question from the research that I want to leave you with. In that Frontiers paper, after discussing all the ways early life stress closes the windows of brain development prematurely, the researchers discussed the tantalizing possibility of pharmacology.
Oh, really? Using medication?
Yes. Preclinical studies are currently investigating whether certain medications, things like the mood stabilizer Valproate, SSRIs like fluoxetine, or even psychedelics like MDMA used in highly controlled clinical settings, might possess the ability to artificially reopen those sensitive periods of neuroplasticity in adulthood.
Reopen the windows.
Exactly. Could the future of treating severe trauma lie not just in coping with the residual damage, but in using medication to literally reopen the childhood windows of our brain, allowing us to rewrite our emotional circuitry entirely from scratch?
That is a profoundly mind-bending concept to consider. The idea that we could fundamentally go back in time, biologically speaking, and lay down entirely new healthy tracks. We've covered a massive amount of ground today, from the unexpected discoveries in a 1980s obesity clinic, through the neurobiology of the HPA axis, all the way to the restorative power of sleep, walking, and stimulating the vagus nerve.
We really have.
If your internal alarm is going off right now, remember, you have the biological tools to turn it down. Take a slow 4-count breath in and a 4-count breath out before you continue with your day. Catch you on the next deep dive.